Technorama interview with Ranger Craig Glasner from Alcatraz.
This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
So, when prisoners on Alcatraz are really bad, where do they go?
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here are your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If you're a new listener to Technorama, thank you for joining us. If you're a returning listener, thank you for returning. We appreciate you giving us your time. I'm Chuck Tomasi, and with me as always is my parolee co-host, Craig Stepp. How are you, Craig?
I'm great. I figured you were going to say something like partner in crime.
Something like that. With us today, we have a special guest on the line. We've known this man for years as a loyal Technorama listener, and we really appreciate that.
Yeah.
He's also a podcast enthusiast and all-around great guy. From the San Francisco Bay Area, it's our pleasure to welcome Ranger Craig Glasner. Welcome to Technorama, Ranger Craig.
It's great to be here.
So how long have you been on Alcatraz?
Oh, geez, about three times longer than the average inmate stay. 19 years, something like that now.
When's your release date?
I'm still waiting for the warden to decide that.
But they have Wi-Fi in the cells now, so that's good.
Yeah. I wish.
He's waiting to hear back from the parole board.
Now, obviously from the title Ranger Craig, I have to ask, what do you do there?
Well, I'm a National Park Ranger in the Division of Interpretation and Education, which means I can't write tickets, I don't carry a gun or a taser, and our job is to educate people about the island, to connect them to the resource.
Okay, now some of our listeners have been to Alcatraz. It's a very fascinating, very interesting place.
I probably saw you there when I was there. It's been 12 years ago or so, maybe.
When he was a kid.
When I was a kid. No, probably more than that, but... But yeah, me and my wife and my brother-in-law went there, and they've both been there before because they're from California. So they're doing the touristy things. So we go to Alcatraz, and I remember taking the tour, and if I remember correctly, everybody carried around a cassette tape with headphones. So I was curious, what are the tours like now? How far has things come along?
It's not that different, except it's no longer a cassette tape. It's an MP3 player.
Mm-hmm.
Which is great because we can have like lots of different languages and just turn on the right language for people. We have some more of the island open to the public. One of the problems we have is so much of the island is not safe. Deteriorating buildings and trails that are like literally falling off the edge of the island. And then there's natural resource issues like bird season, which we just closed off parts of the island here a few weeks ago because of nesting birds and stuff. So probably not that much different than when you visited. But there's more things to see and do, including videos and exhibits and what we call waysides, which are those signs that you see along the trails describing what this is or what you're looking at.
Yeah. I remember wearing the headphones and I went into the cafeteria, and if you time it just right, you start hearing all the, the silverware and the plates knocking around and all the conversation. It's like, wow, that's kind of neat.
There's an interesting story in there. When our Park Association, which is the nonprofit partner for Golden Gate National Recreation Area, when they, 27 years ago, put out a contract to do an audio tour, which seemed to be necessary given how many people wanted to visit and how many staff we could afford to have. Mm-hmm. They put out a contract for an audio tour. And a little company called Antenna Audio, which had never produced anything or done anything in that realm, submitted a proposal. And their proposal was so amazing. I mean, they said, we are going to do what we call oral histories. We're going to record former guards and inmates telling their stories in their own words, and then we're going to weave them together with sound effects. And that's what we've been doing for the last, you know, quarter century or so. And they started on Alcatraz. That was their first project. But they were so successful, they not only have offices all over the world, they recently got bought out by the Discovery Channel and are a subsidiary of them. And they just do amazing work, and it is a great audio tour.
That's neat. Do you still get the former inmates visiting as guests?
You know, sadly, there's less and less of them every day. You know, when I first started out there, we had three or four former inmates coming back. None of them are amongst the living anymore. There's one former inmate that comes back still. There is one former guard that comes back still. We try to have a guest author on the island every day. Well, for two reasons, because it's a great experience for the visitors to Alcatraz to meet someone that lived there or grew up there or worked there or was sent there. Mm-hmm. And the other reason is, perfectly blunt, you know, people buy the books, and that helps us out because all that money comes back to the park. So there's not as many of them as there used to be. And there's a couple that are still in prison, like Whitey Bulger from Boston. But we have actually in the second weekend of August, which is near the anniversary of the opening of the federal penitentiary, we have an alumni event, and we invite as many people as we can get to come back. You know, it used to be there were lots of guards and former inmates when I first started out there. Now a lot of the folks are the children that grew up on the island. Most people don't understand this or are shocked by this. But the guards that lived on Alcatraz, they had their families out there, or their wives and children. And in fact, the children loved living in Alcatraz because it was cool. It was, you know, you could write stories for English class and no one could prove you wrong because they weren't allowed to come out.
Yeah.
What a rare experience that is.
You know, that's kind of weird thinking that somebody would actually have their family near all those dangerous people that were on the island.
But, you know, think about it. Do you know who lives down the street from you? On Alcatraz, everyone that you lived with was a correctional officer, highly trained, very professional. And they didn't even think about the inmates up at the top of the hill. They were probably safer than living in San Francisco, which was only about a 15-minute ferry ride away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you want to see something scary, pull up like a Google map of the sexual predators in your area.
The families felt very safe on the island. The rare exception was when something was going wrong, an escape attempt, a riot, and that wasn't all that often. And then everyone was locked down. So if you were over visiting a neighbor or if you were off island, you didn't move, you know, during that occurrence. And that happened mm-hmm. a few times. But by and large, the families felt very safe out there. They had a post office. They had a little general store. They had a recreation hall, bowling alleys. You know, it was like living in a nice small town where everyone knows everyone. And, you know, 15 minutes away was that sinful city of San Francisco, if you wish to, you know. Go there.
I was going to say more like, you know, from Alcatraz, you have probably one of the better views of San Francisco.
Oh, yes. The views were amazing, which was probably the worst torture of Alcatraz for the inmates. You know, I've known many former inmates over the years. And despite what Hollywood says about Alcatraz, the treatment was very professional. The line is, if you did what you were told, you were treated with respect. Now, mind you, most of the Alcatraz inmates were there because they weren't really good at following the rules. I mean, you didn't get sent to Alcatraz because of your crime, is a rule. Most inmates were sent there because of their behavior. And that was an issue. But, you know, you had a cell to yourself. You were fed well. I mean, you know, it was institutional food, but the guards ate it. It wasn't that bad. And you were treated well as long as you did as what you were told. So it was probably not at all a bad prison to be at, although all prisons are bad.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to ask you to put on your interpretation hat, because Alcatraz is probably best known as the Rock, the prison in the middle of San Francisco Bay. But it's got a richer history if you go back. It didn't start out as a prison.
In fact, the nickname the Rock comes from the military era, which is why it's a national park. The fact that there was a federal penitentiary in Alcatraz had no bearing originally on it being included in the National Park System in 1972. Its history as the first lighthouse on the West Coast was on Alcatraz. That was 1854. Its history is the first U.S.-built fort on the West Coast. Now, mind you, there were other U.S. military installations already in operation, but they were old Spanish presidios and then later Mexican presidios. But the first fully garrisoned fort on the West Coast built by the United States government was the Post on Alcatraces, as it was known at that time. The original name given by the Spanish was Alcatraces, and that was in 1859 that it was garrisoned, meaning that troops started living on the island. There were over 110 cannons on the island. It served a significant, at least to us in the Bay Area, it served an important role during the Civil War. Confederate sympathizers, including some who planned to steal gold from California to help finance the Confederacy, were arrested and incarcerated on Alcatraz. And American Indians during the Indian Wars in the 1800s, including a group of 19 Hopis in 1895, whose crime was wanting to teach their children their language.
For shame.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know.
How dare they?
It's actually a very interesting story. The Hopis were brought to Alcatraz with no trial or hearing because they were not U.S. citizens. They did not have any rights. And it was really a program to re-educate them. They took them on field trips into San Francisco to see the schools and how well they were doing with the children. And they went to the Sutro estate. Adolph Sutro was a very famous San Franciscan, had a wonderful estate out at Ocean Beach. He was a mayor at one time, and he had a great library. And they were allowed to have, according to the newspaper accounts, tea with a touch of brandy, you know, just to show how wonderful our way of life was, with the assumption being that they would want to be like us. So after a year of their re-education program, they returned to Arizona, where they, not surprisingly, in my opinion, continued to resist all U.S. attempts to re-educate them.
Wow. Now there's also things that happened after it was a prison that not a lot of people are aware of either.
Yeah, exactly. Well, talking about Indians, American Indians, one of the most interesting events, I think the most significant event in Alcatraz's history, occurred 6 years after the prison closed, when there was an occupation. Began in November of 1969. Many of the Indians who were living in the Bay Area, some of whom were being relocated under a termination program of the federal government, took over Alcatraz and declared it Indian land. They were very generous. They offered the U.S. government $24 in beads and cloth for the island, sort of a cheek reference to Manhattan, which was actually about seven times more than California Indians were being offered for lands that had been granted to them under the Mexican treaties, which we were all part of Mexico back then here. And the U.S. government said they would honor them, but they didn't. And so this was a very humorous attempt to reclaim Alcatraz as an education center, as a training center, as a cultural center. And that occupation went on for 19 months, which, we'll see how the Occupy movement does that's going on now. But as far as we know, it was the longest occupation of federal land in the history of the country. And despite the fact that the government did not want to give in to them, and there was even a covert operation called Operation Pelican that was meant to discredit them, thanks to the lawyer that worked for Richard Nixon, Leonard Garment, the changes that began to occur in federal policy to American Indians, which led to a policy of self-determination for federally recognized tribes, which came about 1970, it was a major change in federal policy towards the tribes. In fact, some people would say that Alcatraz and the occupation saved the tribes.
That's awesome. Very interesting. I don't think a lot of people know that. I was watching I think it's an independent film. It's on my Netflix queue. I can't remember the name. It was directed and videoed by a Native American from Alaska who came down and wanted to find out what it meant to be, you know, an Indian, an American, and went around to various tribes. And that was included in some of his information was the occupation on Alcatraz. It's very, very well done.
Oh, well, you know, there's a number of good videos and websites out there about that. One I would recommend is Real Injuns. It's actually
What it was called. Yeah. That's it. That was the one I watched. Yeah. Yep.
It's actually a documentary about Hollywood and how it's portrayed Indians.
Yes.
One of the people interviewed in there is John Turdell. John Turdell was one of the Native Americans that occupied Alcatraz. In fact, he had a radio show over Radio Pacifica that he broadcast from the island. He wasn't one of the original occupiers. He came out after Thanksgiving of the first year. But John Turdell went on to become a musician, a poet. He's been in many movies, not just documentaries, but actually is an actor as well. He became a leader of the American Indian Movement, which came more well known after Alcatraz. They weren't really involved with Alcatraz per se. And John, who's a friend of mine, was in that video and talks about Alcatraz.
Hi, this is Grant Imahara from Mythbusters, and Myth Confirmed, you're listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Hey, you can still see some of the evidence from when they were occupied. And some painting on the wall?
Yeah, oh, there's graffiti, some of which we've restored. In fact, right now, I mean, people ask us...
Restored graffiti.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome.
It's funny. If you do graffiti now, it's a crime. But if you did it back in its history, now it's being preserved by the National Park Service. And there's a water tower on the island, which is currently encased in... scaffolding and white plastic because we're trying to save it to prevent it from falling down because it was rusting out. And one of the things we did was enter into consultation with American Indians about how to deal with the fact that the graffiti that was on there was going to be eliminated with the restoration. And what we agreed to do is try to restore the graffiti to preserve that part of the island story. It seems a little strange and it's a little controversial, but it's funny how things become historic depending on how they came about.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, there's the red handprint, if I recall, right?
Right, inside the entrance to the cell house. Yep. There's also Yatta Hay painted on some of the... concrete walls around the island, which was a Navajo word. It's sort of like the Hawaiian word aloha. It sort of can mean goodbye and hello. There's other graffiti, the land of the free, home of the braves.
For a good time, call.
Not that graffiti.
None of that. But we really want to preserve all the different stories of Alcatraz, which is quite a challenge. Alcatraz is like a layer cake. And each layer has different stories to tell. So we have to look at each different part of the island and decide what's the most significant story this room or this wall or this building has to tell. And then that's what our goal is to restore that or preserve that to meet the goals of our mission.
Yeah, it's funny you say layered. It's not only figuratively, but it's literally, you know, the buildings are layered.
Oh, right. In fact, I posted something on the Alcatraz Facebook page the other night, and we're finally trying to get a bathroom in our office.
Oh, wow.
My office is a Civil War era brick structure that was built to house cannons, although it wasn't finished in time to house the cannons. And we have recently electricity. We don't have running water. We use bottled water hooked up to a sink. And so we have to hang bottles off of a tube all the time. And we don't have a bathroom. We have to actually go outside down to the dock to the bathroom that was built to serve the needs of the public. And we're installing a new bathroom in Alcatraz. And that involves something called a macerator. Have you ever heard of the term macerator?
No.
No, I'm scared to ask.
This is the thing that takes what goes into the toilets and processes it so it can be put into a storage tank, loaded onto a barge, and take back to San Francisco.
Okay.
So they're back in an area where they filmed part of the new TV show, the new Alcatraz TV show on Fox, we're having to reuse an area where there was some drainage and put in a macerator and to create a bathroom in our office, which we have never had on Alcatraz. And this is, well, I guess this is endemic of what it's like to work on an island. There's so many different nuances of working on an island.
We'll work that bathroom thing into season two somehow.
Well, I actually took a picture of one of the maintenance people in there the other day, and I posted it on Facebook, and I said, this is a picture of A, someone recreating an escape attempt, B, someone trying to find the, from the Alcatraz TV show, bat room on Alcatraz, because they filmed back in that area, or C, someone installing a macerator, which, you know, heaven knows, I never knew what a macerator was until I worked on Alcatraz. So.
Are the passages where Clint Eastwood used to escape still there?
Well, actually, when they filmed Escape from Alcatraz, they filmed on Broadway, which is the middle aisle within the cell house. There's four cell blocks on Alcatraz, and the cell blocks are sort of like, well, they're like a building within a building, because no outside wall of a cell ever touched an outside wall of the building by design.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so is that kind of isolated by itself?
Right. And they were not allowed to film in the actual escape cells. They filmed in a different section of the cell house because we didn't want them to damage the actual escape cells. In hindsight, they were allowed to enlarge air vents in news cells because there were questions we had about rebar and the integrity of the concrete and stuff. And when they came out to film that, apparently the Park Service thought this was a good opportunity to resolve some of those questions. So, actually, a lot of Escape from Alcatraz was filmed on the island. A lot of about the movie was not true. For example, in the movie, you're led to believe that Frank Morris, played by Clint Eastwood, was the guy that planned the escape. And by most accounts, it was actually a fourth man, Alan West, who did not get out that night. But that wouldn't have been a very good part for Clint Eastwood. So they kind of changed the story. and this is typical of Alcatraz. I mean, they want a big name actor. Well, a big name actor is not going to be the guy that plans the escape and doesn't get out.
He's waving at the raft as it's going away.
Right.
So long.
It's kind of what happened. So that they will change things around to make it a better story because they want the big name actor because that sells tickets. For example, the Birdman of Alcatraz. I'm sorry. There was no Birdman of Alcatraz.
That's what I remember from the tour as well.
Right. I mean, Robert Stroud was the Canary Doctor of Leavenworth, and who would buy a ticket to that movie?
Yeah.
Because when they began making the movie, he was in Alcatraz. They capitalized on that and titled him the Birdman of Alcatraz, as had catchy. A previous book. Yeah. And he also wasn't the sympathetic character in the movie that led to people signing petitions outside of theaters in 1962 to get him released from prison, who were totally unaware of the fact that he was a psychopath and a sociopath. In fact, I've asked a lot of people that knew him. I've known inmates like Martin Sabell, who was convicted with the Rosenbergs over the spying the Soviet spies, and yeah, I knew for many years. I haven't seen him for a while, and everyone says that Robert Stroud was maybe more like Hannibal Lecter, if you want a movie reference.
People
signed petitions outside of theaters, unaware that at that very time, now at Springfield, Missouri, at a medical facility, the real Robert Stroud was telling a parole board he hoped to be paroled because he didn't think he was going to live a lot longer, which he didn't, and he still wanted to kill some people.
Oh, I could have left that last little part out, but okay.
Well, ironically, he died and about a year later, a little less than a year later, and that probably would have been huge headlines given the Academy Award-nominated movie, except the headline that day was the assassination of President Kennedy in Dallas.
Oh, he was trumped.
Yep.
Robert Stroud gets page 8.
Which is ironically appropriate, in my opinion.
As it should be. It should be. Now, you mentioned the new J.J. Abrams show, Alcatraz, on Fox. How much of the show was filmed there?
Actually, very little. They came out for 2 days. which, well, if you're making a movie, 2 days is about 15 minutes of video of movie.
Sure.
TV's a little different. It's more like about 45 minutes. They were out on the island for 2 days, but almost everything you see is being done, I don't know if it's CGI or sets or whatever. Very little of it is actually Alcatraz. Not the last episode, but the third episode had a beautiful view of a guard leaving the apartments, which we know as Building 64. And it was amazing. It looked just like it, except it looked a lot better than the real thing.
Can we have that?
To be honest, we don't know if they built a set or if that was CGI or whatever. I mean, obviously the Bat Cave and the Bat Phone and all that stuff doesn't exist. I mean, they did do some filming on the island. There's a great shot of Jorge Garcia and, oh, what's the woman that plays the cop? I can't think of her name right now. In any case, coming down a brick stairwell with a brick wall. I mean, that was filmed back in what's known as Chinatown, which is in Building 64. It's an old part of Alcatraz. Yep. So they did some stuff out there, but more than anything, they just collected data about what it looked like and tried to recreate it elsewhere because it's expensive to film on Alcatraz.
I was going to say, I bet it's not cheap.
No. In fact, I got an email a couple of weeks ago from the production folks. They wanted to film a scene at the pier in San Francisco where the guards and the inmates and the family members came and went from. And I sent them to Google and showed them where that was. It was called Lower Fort Mason, which still exists. It's part of the national park now. And it looks very much like it did back then. And so they're really, really trying hard to make things look right other than the stuff they have to just make up.
Here's Craig. Let me Google that for you.
but you know, they're not willing to pay the fees that it costs to film on the island, apparently. So although we hear that if they do well, they might want to come back and do some more filming actually on the island. But, you know, when you see a cell on Alcatraz in the TV show, it probably isn't really on Alcatraz. Very little beyond the first and second episode were actually filmed on the island.
Hi, this is Edward James Olmos, Battlestar Commander Adama, and you're listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama. Don't forget, frack off.
There was a show or two ago where the daughter had grown up on the island and, you know, her dad was dead, but they went into what was supposedly their old dwellings. And I thought that could be any old house.
Well, you know, and it looked really like what's on Alcatraz.
It did. It really did.
But it's in a lot better shape than what really is on Alcatraz at this point.
I mean, they'd be falling through the floors if they tried filming there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. And that's great. That's fine. I mean, we don't care. Our job as the National Park Service is not to tell Hollywood what to do. We're very lenient in terms of them doing what they wanted to do. I mean, a good example is the movie Murder in the First with Christian Slater, Kevin Bacon, Gary Oldman, which was a totally fictitious story as written by a writer. Yet they tried to throw in real elements of the island so that when it came out, they could claim it was inspired by true events. And when you think about it, inspired by true events has no legal standing. So,
speaking of true events, do you know if the current show is using the real names of prisoners and inmates on the show?
No, there's no connection to any reality.
That's all made up.
Oh, completely made up.
Okay. I was just curious if they took like, hey, let's take the names of the last 300 people in 1963 and go with that.
No, the guards, the staff, the doctor, the hospital, all of that is completely fictitious. And I hope people understand that because one of the ironies of this, even though Hollywood and TV helps promote us, is people come out wondering about that. And we have to explain, no, that's not the way it was. And people sometimes don't trust us. We are the government after all.
No.
I had someone come up to me after Murder and the First came out and claim they believed the movie and they didn't trust me, which means they don't know me because I'm a very honest person. I'm not In my opinion, I'm a historian first, and I work for the government second. And I will try to be as honest as possible at all times. And then when I know stories about, for example, conscientious objectors for religious reasons during World War I who were horribly, horribly treated by the U.S. Army, I will tell those stories. I have no misgivings about doing that, even though it might make the government look bad, because that is the truth and that is history. Mm-hmm. But it was very frustrating when Murder in the First came out and people didn't want to believe me because they wanted to believe what they saw on the big screen.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where everybody gets their history from, right? TV and movies.
Well, sadly, that seems to be true to a lot of people. You know, and there's nothing wrong with that. There are wonderful pieces of work that have been done for documentaries. There have been even good movies. I always talk about Apollo 13. Apollo 13, I was a huge science fiction fan, and I watched the Mercury flights. I watched the Gemini flights. I mean, on a black and white TV. We had three TVs set up in our living room during Apollo 11. So if someone went to a commercial, we could see it. So I'm a huge fan of NASA and the space program. And of course, Apollo 13 was a pretty dramatic event in American history. And they made a movie. And the movie used actual transcripts from NASA for much of it, although they had to create a lot of dramatic scenes that aren't documented, you know, to make it a good movie. So there are good movies out there. There are good documentaries out there. But when it comes to The Rock, no one's really, really – well, actually, there was a made-for-TV movie called Six Against the Rock, and they hired a former guard and a former inmate that talks about a horrible riot and escape attempt that occurred in 46. It took the military to suppress it. And that's probably the best thing that's ever been done in terms of Hollywood about Alcatraz. Again, Escape from Alcatraz isn't horrible. I could probably only sit down and pick out maybe 70 or 80 things that are not true in that.
Yeah, I could see you sitting on the couch going, oh, no, that's not why, no way that worked like that.
Well, you know, I wasn't on Alcatraz when it first opened, but apparently the Park Service tried to like pretend none of that Hollywood stuff ever happened. By the time I got there about, you know, 20 years ago, we kind of embraced Hollywood because we realized that's why everyone was coming. That's why we sell out over a week in advance in the summer. That's why we are known worldwide. Well, why not embrace that and utilize that and use that as a tool to begin to tell the real stories of Alcatraz? And that's what I try to do in a program called Hollywood's Alcatraz that I do, you know, pretty regularly on the island.
What about Ken Burns?
Oh, well, you know, he hasn't done anything about Alcatraz. No, Ken, he did a great documentary for PBS on the national parks a few years ago.
Yeah, I did.
Mm-hmm.
And
I caught most of those. Those were fantastic.
In fact, let me look. Yes, I have the Ken Burns effect on my computer. no, he's been great in promoting the national parks, and we partnered with him when he did that PBS special a few years ago.
That was neat. And when I was out there, I really appreciate the tickets to get to see the premiere of that. That was a lot of fun.
Oh, I forgot we had done that for you. That's right.
Yeah, that was neat.
So for people that don't know, you came out at my request and did a training for the National Park Service for the Pacific West region of the National Park Service on podcasting a couple years ago. And to your credit, we paid your way and we put you up, but you did not accept payment for your time. And that is still legendary in the Park Service. And in fact, what you started has become a training that we now do through our Harpers Ferry Center.
It's called Get Them for Free. I have my Alcatraz key and the cup that you gave me, and the National Park Service bag proudly carries my Bible to church every week.
Oh, that's wonderful, because you were wonderful, and people still talk about how influential you were and the work they're doing to this day.
I'll tell you, that was... You know, there's people who know technology that want to be podcasters, and there's people who have the interpretation talent of the National Park Service, and it made it so much fun that you guys already had the knack or the stuff to be good narrators, to be good storytellers. And then it was just a matter of teaching the technology, which was, you know, 1, 2, 3, we're done. So that really made a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, that was a great week. I was so happy to have been part of that.
Hey, me Craig, too. Now, me from too. From here on out, don't mention Legendary and Chuck in the same sentence, please. It just makes life unbearable
okay,
for me.
I'll try to avoid that.
Yeah. Now that we got all that out of the way. So, well, speaking of like Hollywood types and stuff like that, you know, I remember seeing the Mythbusters episode where they came out and filmed trying to recreate some of the escape or the fabled escape, you know, planes. Right. Were you there when that happened?
I wasn't there the day they filmed it. I've actually run into them. I mean, they're local boys, you know, so I run into them at tech geeky events and stuff like that. And, you know, and what they did was great. But if you talk to the Coast Guard people and if you look at the actual raft and life jackets they built, the so-called raft, it seems a little less likely. You know, here's my take on the whole story. These were three guys that always got into trouble. They escaped, they got into prison. They escaped, they got back into prison. And now they disappear. They completely disappear. I've been out in that bay in a wetsuit, which they did not have the advantage of having. And, you know, I don't think they made it. Because I think that if they had made it, we would have heard something.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the sister of the two Anglin brothers from Florida are coming back. She's coming back this year, the 50th anniversary. And she thinks they made it. But according to the FBI, she has no proof of that because they've been heavily investigated, questioned. It's still an open case, ironically. There's a U.S. Marshal here in San Francisco, a good friend of mine, by the name of Michael Dyke. You can look him up on the web and see what he has to say. He thinks it's very unlikely that all three of them were washed out to sea and not one body was ever recovered. Right. So he has, in my time on Alcatraz, knowing him, investigated two leads about that escape. One was an alleged deathbed manuscript of someone that was on the outside that helped them. But when they helped them escape and then when they went to find some money that was buried somewhere from a former bank job, the other guys decided to kill the escapees because the authorities were looking for the escapees, not for the guys that helped them. And they figured, why take part of the money? We'll take all the money.
Yeah, why not?
There was this amazing manuscript that surfaced in a bookstore that alleged to be the confession of someone, and they investigated it and they decided it was a hoax. Now Mike called me about it when it first surfaced, and we got to see a couple pages of it. And when I read the couple pages of this manuscript, it was all stuff I could have showed you a book we sell in Alcatraz that had that information. It just
really?
It just sounded too. And so I was suspicious, and other people, including Julian Babiak, who's a former child of Alcatraz, who's written a number of books about Alcatraz, she kind of felt the same way. And that's what they decided, that it really was just a hoax, that people had taken information that was out there and created this manuscript. The second one, you know, and it's funny, Mike calls me about these when he first finds out about them, just to sort of get my input. And I can't talk about it because this is now an official ongoing investigation of the U.S. Marshal Service. So I have to keep this quiet until, you know, the story ends. And it's very frustrating. And I always tell them, I hope you don't find out what happened, because I like the fact that we don't know what happened, because that makes for a better story.
Yeah,
in any case,
true.
The second story was there was a fellow in the East that they found who had the same first and last name, a different middle name. The guy who this name was connected to in terms of government records had, according to some records, already died. So they thought this was maybe one of the Anglin brothers assuming the identity of someone else. And they were able to collect some DNA material and determine that that was not the case, that there was just an erroneous record in the military files. And this guy was the guy he said he was, not one of the Anglins who escaped from Alcatraz. So, you know, yeah, it's it's again, Michael's a great guy. I love him dearly, and I don't agree with him.
This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics, author of the new book, Physics of the Impossible. Yet, I can't even figure out Technorama.
Craig, are you one of those guys that has a picture with every movie star that's come by on the island?
You know, I do that sometimes, including... We had someone come out after The Rock claiming he was Sean Connery. And he sure looked at him. Turns out it was a lookalike trying to convince an agent. And you know, we kept going, you know, he seems a little shorter this time around. You know, because I got to hang out with the real Sean Connery when they were doing The Rock.
Somebody left him in the dryer too long.
Yeah, well, it turns out he was trying to get this agent to hire him to be a lookalike and came out to Alcatraz to prove that he could pull it off. And, you know, it worked. We fell for it, even though we were all a little suspicious. I mean, one of the traditions of some of the rangers on the island is to have people autograph the inside of our hats. And, you know, we have all kinds of people that have come out. Everyone that comes to San Francisco at some time or another wants to come to Alcatraz.
Sure.
So we've had, you know, prime ministers, we've had presidents, we've had daughters of presidents and mothers of presidents. And Nancy Pelosi showed up one day with her grandchildren, you know. It's just Alcatraz is so famous that you never knew. We had a call from some country the other day that they wanted a special private tour, and we kind of don't do that unless it's requested through official channels and approved by the State Department or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we've had very famous – well, one of my favorite events was Robin Williams, who's a local resident, who actually has done a lot of support for our national park. He's done benefits and stuff like that. I worked with him at Fort Point when he did a movie, unfortunately not the movie I hoped it would be, called Bicentennial Man. I mean, I love Isaac Asimov. I actually knew Isaac Asimov through my science fiction connections for a number of years before he passed away. And it was one of my favorite short stories, and they did a movie about it, and they were filming down at Fort Point when I was working there for a while. And later on, his people called us, and he was bringing Richard Pryor out to Alcatraz. Now, this was after Richard was very ill and somewhat reclusive, and they kind of wanted to know if we could help them out, avoiding too much public attention. And you know, the way these things work is sometimes it's better to help them than to not, even though we don't want to do them special treatment, because it disrupts the experience of other visitors. So we said, yeah, we'll show you around. And mind you, Richard Pryor was, in my mind, a hero. He used a very powerful tool called comedy to help change the racial relations in this country, in my opinion. Yep. So I was very happy to show them around. And that was a very weird situation. Robbins is an interesting person. I used to run into him with his kids, with my kids and me, in line at a Japanese restaurant over in Japantown when I first moved here. A little soba place. If you've never had soba, it's a buckwheat noodle that's sort of like Japanese fast food. And we would see him over there once in a while. And I would run into him at the playgrounds with his kids when I had my kids there. And so I would start trying to do my job as an interpreter, talking about, for example, Al Capone mopping floors in the cell house. And then Robin would jump off into some weird tangent imitating Al Capone mopping the floors of Alcatraz.
Nice.
I so wish I had a tape of this stuff, but, you know, we don't do that kind of thing. We get a lot of VIPs and mucky mucks and very important people to come out that we have to accommodate sometimes. But by the same token, I got a call from some representative of a hotel who was doing concierge service for a dignitary from another country, and they wanted a private tour. And I said, well, you know, we don't do that as a rule, and I've referred them to our administrative staff over at our park headquarters.
What are some things that people wouldn't know, like, you know, little hidden gems about Alcatraz that you think they should know?
Well, you know, we've already mentioned a lot of them. I mean, the military history is very fascinating, and we're trying to expand that. We have actually, we've partnered with a local Civil War historian group who's doing a lot of interpretation. They come out and they dress up in period uniforms. They actually do reenactments on the island, you know, escorting prisoners up and down the hill and stuff like that. They do that a couple of years, a couple times a year. And the gardens, I mean, we have a relationship with a group called the Gardens Conservancy, which is a nonprofit group that partnered with our Parks Conservancy, the Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy, to restore the gardens in Alcatraz. And they're doing amazing work. We have historic roses on Alcatraz that no one knew still existed. And apparently, roses are kind of like women's fashion. they kind of come and go. And you know, what's popular this year might not be next year. And there was a variety of rose found on the island that no one knew still existed in reality. And we're now putting them into greenhouses and making them available to continue that species. The birds, we have an amazing colony of birds on Alcatraz. Cormorants, black-crowned night herons, western gulls, and that these are the stories of Alcatraz that, you know, everyone comes out for the prison, but there's the Indians, there's the military history, there's the gardens, there's the birds. Banana slugs. My son happens to be a student at UC Santa Cruz whose mascot is the banana slug. We have banana slugs in Alcatraz.
and some great park rangers.
It's one of the things that's so very cool about working in Alcatraz is there's so many different stories that depending on your mood, you can decide which one to tell. We can talk about ecology. We can talk about global warming. We can talk about the bay and its importance and its problems, like the mercury, selenium, and DDT that still exist in San Francisco Bay due to historic decisions made by us. It's just such a diverse place that I think it has something to offer for everyone. We often get emails and calls about, well, is it appropriate to bring little kids out to Alcatraz? Well, you know, they may not be interested in the prison as such, but the hill, the birds, the flowers, everyone that comes to Alcatraz finds something that they like.
Mm-hmm. Where can the listener find out more about Alcatraz, particularly if they're in the area and may want to take a visit?
Well, the important thing is to get a ticket early if you want to come out and visit. And that website is AlcatrazCruises.com. They are the concessioner that we have a contract with. So, or you can go to our website, www.nps.gov/Alcatraz, and there's links there, not only to a lot of historical information, but also to the concessioner in order to purchase tickets, which, as I said before, in the summer, you want to do that at least a week, if not even more in advance, because we frequently sell out. We also have a page on our website that links to a lot of other sites, including the Bureau of Prisons, the FBI, and writers and other people that have stuff online about Alcatraz. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/Alcatraz. We're on Twitter, twitter.com/Alcatraz Island, because someone in Russia already got the name Alcatraz. You know, we try to be out there. In fact, the first Park Service website ever was on Alcatraz Island when, in 1995, I used Usenet to recruit folks from the Bay Area, Silicon Valley. I thought this web thing was going to be really big. I had been on BBSs and CompuServe and Genie, and no one else seemed to understand this stuff in the Park Service. So I just put out a message on Usenet and recruited people, and we spent a night on Alcatraz in the prison. Well, not that any of us slept, come to think of it. And we produced the very first National Park Service website back in 1995.
Hey, I'm looking at the Facebook page. Looks like one of the England brothers just friended you.
Yeah. I'll have to get back to that when we're done.
How convenient.
How do you prevent other boaters from...
Well, there's only one dock, really. And so that's pretty easy. We've had a few incidents, including during Fleet Week with the U.S. Navy. We had a Navy boat pull up, and they wanted to offload. And we're going, no, you can't do that. And some guy with, like, several stars, two or three stars on his shoulder, was challenging me. And I said, no, you can't do that because there's a ferry coming in right behind you that needs this slip. So we have had, you know, fish boats show up and people show up and try to sneak on the island, and probably times we've never caught them, you know. But the army made the island so that there was really only one place you could dock by design. That was part of the design of the fort. So the cliffs they put in and stuff like that, they put in what's now become tide pools around the perimeter to make it difficult to access the island. So it was really by design that there's really only one good spot where you can bring a boat in.
Yeah, Craig, I know we could go on for hours and really appreciate all the great information. Thank you very much for being part of this. And
It was a pleasure. I love doing this kind of stuff. And, you know, I've been on Dr. Floyd and some other podcasts and stuff. And to me, it's just so much fun. One of the Rangers was asking me, well, are you getting paid for this? And I go, well, no, there's this community we call podcasters.
That's right.
And everyone just sort of helps everyone out, you know, and everyone's happy to do anything to support each other.
That's all the time we have for this show. Once again, special thanks to Ranger Craig Lasner for joining us and sharing his knowledge and stories of such a fascinating place like Alcatraz. We also appreciate your support by listening to the show. If you like the show, there are many ways to show your love. All are available on the website at chuckchat.com/technorama. Also want to thank Mad Marv for providing all the great blog content during the week. If you're not a regular subscriber or visitor to the Technorama website, go over to chuckchat.com/technorama. You can find everything there. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech. You can find out more at friendsintech.com. We're also affiliated with all the great podcasts over at farpointmedia.com. Go over there, check them out. We're sure there's something over there you're going to like. If you like this, you'll like a lot of those too. Until next time, tell a friend about Technorama, and as always, a binary high five.
101. Hey, Chuck, look what I found in this cake.
404, file not found.